WBOI Presents In Session is a series where we'll hear from teachers, educators, and experts on all sorts of topics, sharing their lessons in the WBOI studios. As part of our commitment to lifelong learning, In Session gives us an opportunity to partner with those who have something to teach us. During this episode, we'll hear from Adam DeVille from the University of St. Francis on the topic of Unmasked, a look at the issue of clerical sex abuse in the Catholic Church. Thank you for listening. Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. I always have to include a full disclosure when I'm in the studio with a guest from the University of St. Francis. I'm a proud alumnus. This time, though, I probably should include an additional disclosure. I am Catholic. It's been a hard couple of years. I was really too young to grasp what all was going on in Boston in the early 2000s when the Catholic Church was rocked by an abuse crisis. The latest abuse revelations that have come from Washington, Pennsylvania, seemingly every corner of the church really have been a lot to unpack. Nonetheless, we're going to attempt to do that. To unpack this issue and how to respond to it, I'm joined in the studio by Adam DeVille, Associate Professor of Theology and Director of Humanities at the University of St. Francis. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, before we start rolling here, you and I talked a little bit about how this is a complicated problem that goes beyond just simply needing better systems to hold people accountable. When there are scandals in the church or even politics, it's easy to call for accountability for someone you disagree with or lump the problem in with one group or another.
A solution for thee, but not for me, as the saying goes. That's clearly not going to help. The other thing to be clear on is that no system is perfect. There will always be flaws when you're dealing with flawed human beings. That said, I think it's clear the present system in the church is the worst of all possible worlds, insofar as it preserves absolute monopolies on power, and thus has deeply exacerbated the present crisis, which is one of many parts. An abuse of sex, yes, but also of money and especially of power.
We hear about those issues when dealing with abuse outside of the church as well. It's an abuse of power as well, sexual abuse. And there's not a clear way to lump every victim or accused abuser together.
Right. You know, many times in the past months, I've asked myself quite seriously this question. It sounds like a flippant question, but can Catholics not walk and chew gum at the same time? As this sex abuse crisis has gone on relentlessly, the ideologies by which people explain the causes have also gone on relentlessly, with few people seeming to be open to realizing that this is a crisis of many parts. The idea that it can be reduced to just one cause, typically clericalism or homosexuality, and requires just one solution, beggars belief. It's a deeply un-Catholic instinct to reduce things so simplistically and to create grotesques instead of finely drawn detailed portraits of both lights and shadows. Karl Barth, perhaps the most famous Protestant theologian of the mid-20th century, who did not shy away from blunt views about the church, once said that the most dangerous word in Catholicism was "and," by which he meant that Catholics are always adding just one more piece to their worldview. Christ is God and man. Mary is virgin and mother. The church is sinless and full of sinners. But in looking at the ideological monologues and monocausal explanations in the church today, I'm not sure he would say that. And to my mind, that's a tremendous impoverishment.
This is WBOI Presents In Session. Our guest instructor is Adam DeVille, and this episode is Unmasked. So when these in-session conversations air, they're in groups of three. There will be other discussions about addressing abuse in communities and between countries. But you and I are going to go more in depth on the abuse crisis within the Catholic Church. You've written a book called Everything Hidden Shall Be Revealed, Ridding the Church of Abuses of Sex and Power. You spoke about the book a while back with WBOI News Director Rebecca Green, so let's start with a recap.
Yes, so my book does something that nobody else has done to date, to look at the structural issues in the church and to show how and where the lack of local accountability is a huge problem, but also one of recent vintage. The historical work I do in the book is to show that earlier eras in the church, and in other parts of the church even today, we find better structures of local accountability, which we desperately need to recover and reinstitute today. Many of those structures can be found in the Orthodox churches, the Greek, the Russian, but especially the Armenian. But some of them can also be found in North American, Anglican, and Episcopalian structures too. The book focuses on structural issues to avoid the blame game. Too often today, many people in the church want to blame either homosexuality or clericalism. I find both overlook the need for structural change, and neither fully realizes that this is an abuse of sex, but it's also of power and money. That will not be changed by proposals that say, well, we just need to reinforce clerical celibacy, or we need to better screen the sexual histories of those accepted to seminaries. That totally overlooks the problem of power, with which, as Freud taught us, sex is so often deeply intertwined. So what we have is a crisis of sex and power. It's largely focused on boys and young men, and yet we have increasing numbers of nuns and other women in the church reporting abuse. It is committed by priests and bishops. It is also covered up by bishops and popes.
When I think back to my own upbringing and education as I went through Catholic grade schools, high school, and college, my time in those places was influenced greatly by, thankfully, good examples of priests and pastors. I think that's one area where people might think, well, what am I supposed to do? Our pastor is great. Our bishop seems to be addressing the issue well. But one term I learned in Catholic school is subsidiarity. The best way to address any issue that might come up is at the most immediate and local level possible.
And that's what sets my book apart. It gives answers to precisely those questions of yours. It starts at the local level with what is easiest and the most localized set of reforms, those in the parish, which is the place where most Catholics interact regularly and officially with the church. I argue that one concrete thing people can do is to start demanding that their parish, every parish, have a parish council, which cannot be ignored. It must be required, and any major decisions affecting the parish, including the annual budget and the pastoral leadership of the priest and other clergy, must be voted on by that council. No more can priests have monopolies on power, running parishes like their own private benefices. No more can bishops treat priests like private employees they drop into or yank out of parishes entirely on their own. One of the recurring features in this crisis, going back decades, is how bishops removed priests accused of abuse and just sent them somewhere else, telling neither the old nor the new parish the reason for the change. In my proposal, that will no longer be possible. The bishop and parish council must work together if a change in leadership is necessary, and each must be totally honest with and transparent to the other.
Earlier in our conversation, you said a solution for thee, but not for me. Clearly, demands for accountability aren't going through an organization that historically thinks in centuries. What are those advocating for reform up against? Is using the word reform part of the problem?
Yes. The word reform, like the word change, is sometimes a threat to Catholics. The Catholic Church is, by any reading, the most conservative institution on the planet in some ways. You don't survive 2,000 years without hanging on to a lot. So for some, the demand for reform and accountability is taken as a threat to what they perceive to be some fundamental nature or structure in the church. To others, of course, it's a threat to their power. And still others project onto the idea of accountability their own fantasies and delusions about democracy or the French Revolution's reign of terror or some such. What I try to do is to say to people that accountability is not about swapping one monopoly for another, not about shoving one group, the bishops, aside and replacing them with another. It's not about dividing one group from another, setting them at each other's throats. That only makes things worse. Rather, accountability has to be seen as the mutual interdependence and interaction of the three orders in the church: hierarchs, clerics, and laics, a term I borrow from the Russian Orthodox scholar Nicholas Afanasyev, to indicate that the people in the church are not lay in the sense of non-professionals who lack rank or training or status. The laic are one of the three orders in the church alongside the clerics and the bishops.
I do want to stay on the idea of the laics for a moment, just because, well, for the majority of the church, for those who are part of the church but are not in an ordained position, that is the category that we would fall into. Mm-hmm. How has their, well, it's a word we keep using, how has their power in these situations grown lessened or changed over the course of the history of the church, both worldwide as well as here in the United States?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, particularly if you start here in the U.S., because what we find today in 2019 is almost a kind of a total reversal of what we would have seen throughout the 19th century. This country, as we know, is composed of a lot of immigrants, and lots of Catholics came here from other countries and through their own hard work and sweat and money, built up parish communities right across the country. In a lot of cases, they didn't have a priest initially. So they went ahead and built the church, paid for it, bought the property, owned the property themselves, and then started looking for a priest. And they controlled all of that. And in some cases, they even tried to hire and fire the priest. And bishops were really on the periphery. Well, as you can imagine, bishops weren't happy with that. And so they gradually sought to sort of rein that in. In the historical literature, it goes under the trusteeism. You had these people who were trustees for parishes holding all the power, basically, and bishops felt like, no, that's my job. And so the bishops gradually tried to rein that in. And so what we have today is, in fact, the total opposite of that. Bishops have now reined that in and have exclusive control over parishes and all the decisions that get made. And the laic, the people, have basically been completely cut off. It's been a total reversal.
I do want to shift focus a little bit, seeing as we had a development that broke just this week with Cardinal Pell and Australia. Obviously, this is an issue that is representative of the church worldwide, the Australian piece being just one piece of it. But what are your thoughts on the situation with Cardinal Pell and how we have seen this play out with the church and with, I guess you could say, coverage of this issue over the course of the last couple of years?
My thoughts are twofold. First, I've actually been to Australia in 1991, however, but that in no way entitles me to sit in judgment in 2019, even as somehow many other Catholics seem to think it does. I am honestly appalled at the many Catholics I'm seeing on social media this week who've never been to Australia, who were not in the courtroom to hear the testimony at Pell's trial, but nonetheless seem to know infallibly what the right verdict is and what it means. I'd like to think I have, and we all need more of, some epistemic humility to not sit in judgment on matters for which I'm not trained, and indeed was not physically present on another continent almost 10,000 miles away. Second, Catholics should also have learned by now that churchmen reputed for their orthodoxy and their conservatism can and have been abusers, just as churchmen considered liberals have also been abusers and covered up for them. So stop trying to fit this crisis into your preconceived narratives, is what I would say to Catholics.
For better or worse, many of these cases get tried in the court of public opinion. That's unlikely to change at this point. Within the church, though, it seems we've seen a bit of a paradigm shift in recent years when looking at this issue. Is it fair to say that the church is emphasizing the personal moral failure of the perpetrator less and is emphasizing the harm done to the victim or the victims more? Perhaps that's following some of the large numbers of victims we've seen reported in the last couple of years.
Yes, that puts it very well. If you read some of the reports of accused clergy and their personnel files kept by bishops, as I have, or memoirs of bishops, one of which I'm reading right now, there's often this more in regret than in anger kind of tone that pervades these texts because, well, Father so-and-so's had a bit of a lapse with the booze and the altar boys again, and we had to send him to our retreat center for a few days. There's a kind of a mild moralizing tone here that's completely oblivious to the massive harm done. What the psychiatrist Leonard Schengold, who did pioneering research into the effects of childhood sexual abuse, has rightly called soul murder. The church, along with the world at large, has come, thanks to a huge body of research over the last 30 years, to understand that sexual abuse of children is the cause of major, massive, and lasting trauma, causing immediate and direct harm to the victim, but also to his or her family and others in the community.
The coverage of the abuse crisis doesn't always land on the NPR airwaves, but when it does, well, one story I think a lot of people will remember was a meeting of the USCCB that was going to happen to address this issue in Rome, basically saying, wait, and wanting to have this conversation later on. And I think for a lot of people who get frustrated when, well, it's kind of the classic for evil to succeed, you just need good people to do nothing, or you just need the people in a position of power to do nothing. And if you were looking for a good example of that, where perhaps popes and bishops aren't doing what they should, there it was.
That's right. It put me in mind of a very kind of acid comment that Otto von Bismarck, you know, the Prussian chancellor of the 19th century, who was no fan of Catholics, said after Vatican I that the bishops of the world are just reduced to being the Pope's postman. They just sort of drop messages that the Pope has written for them and do exactly what he tells them. And that's not what bishops are supposed to do. And so when they were told stand down, and then they very meekly did, I think they lost whatever remaining shreds of credibility and authority they had in the eyes of most people. Because what came after that, this meeting in Rome a few months later, hasn't done anything. And one of the things that's really clear, I think, in this crisis is that we need people to be willing to stand up and take the initiative where they are. The other piece I argue in my book is that standing around waiting for the Pope to tell people what to do is a fool's game. Even for the Pope just to tell bishops what to do, never mind the 1.5 billion Catholics in the world what to do, because you've got more than 5,000 bishops in the world, and nobody can supervise 5,000 people. So waiting for the Pope to tell people what to do or what they can't do is just not a serious way forward.
While we're on the subject of NPR coverage, and before we have the mics rolling, I do want to mention, you mentioned Silvia Pajoli and her coverage before I did, but she had a story that referenced hashtag nuns too, and you mentioned that women in the church have been reporting these issues as well. Any thoughts you want to elaborate on there?
Yeah, you know, we see the same dynamics at work in the broader Me Too movements that we've been seeing in Hollywood and politics, Jeffrey Epstein and countless others, of women not being believed. And that's been no less true in the Catholic world as it has been in Hollywood or Washington politics or New York or anywhere else. And I think that's one story that I actually wrote to Silvia Pajoli after that piece came out. And I said, thank you for that. I hope you're going to stay on the file because we need to hear this. And Catholics aren't going to be forthcoming about this. As we've discovered, we need media attention to ferret this out. And that's a big piece that's still to emerge, I think. You know, her story, as I recall, was largely focused on Europe and Africa. We haven't heard as much here in North America, but we know those stories are there. And it fits the broader pattern of abuse of sex and power, which again is the same dynamic we've seen in the other Me Too movements that are exposing this kind of abuse of women.
Not everyone listening to our conversation is Catholic or perhaps even religious. I do want to look at this issue in the context of what we've seen in national and international events over the last several years. We've already hit on several. Movements like hashtag Me Too or Black Lives Matter have come out of a place of demanding accountability. I think it's fair to say for many, how can the church speak from a place of leadership addressing issues like these today unless it takes some concrete steps towards accountability? A parable about specks and beams comes to mind.
Yes, absolutely. I despair that the church has lost that kind of credibility because it hasn't kept its own house in order. I'm working on a piece right now about the long-term prospects of bishops and leaders recovering any real prospect and practice of moral authority to speak out on crucial issues today where we need to hear their voices on immigration, on racism, on poverty, on gun violence, and all the rest. It's clear, sadly, that until and unless bishops and popes make serious reforms internally to the church, their ability to speak externally to the world will be virtually non-existent.
Adam DeVille, thank you so much for being a part of Season 2 of WBOI Presents In Session. Thank you for the perspective you bring to an issue that is not easy to discuss for Catholics and non-Catholics alike. I appreciate you being willing to share more with our listeners.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I'm delighted to be here.
And thank you for listening to WBOI Presents In Session. Find more episodes of WBOI Presents In Session at WBOI.org. And while you're there, you can find the very latest from the WBOI news team. And stay up to date on content we produce year-round. Our theme music is by Noah Campodonico. Our sound effects are by John Dawkins. Our web producer is Loyal Vandenberg. Our WBOI intern is Monica Blankenship. Thank you for listening.